You're listening to The Voice of Russia. I'm Howell Davis. And today's debate is about Britain's nuclear weapons. Until last month, Britain's nuclear deterrent, currently the Trident submarine missile system, was low down the agenda in most newsrooms. But the suggestion by the Liberal Democrat, Sir Nick Harvey, that the replacement for Trident could downgrade its capabilities has ignited the debate over Britain's nuclear weapons. Sir Nick's words had added punch because until last month he was the minister leading a government review of Trident's successor. He argued that there's a strong financial and military imperative for that downgrading, arguing it's possible to save money while keeping the country safe. So is that possible? And more fundamentally, is the end of Trident an opportunity to discuss getting rid of Britain's nuclear weapons altogether? I'm joined now by Dr. Kate Hudson, General Secretary for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Toby Fenwick, Research Associate at Centre Forum and the author of a report, Dropping the Bomb, A Post-Trident Future. And down the line from Westminster, we have Dr. Julian Lewis, a Conservative MP and the former Shadow Defence Minister from 2002 to 2010. And from Berlin, we have Ben Harris-Quinney. He's chairman at the right-wing think tank, the Bow Group. If I might start with Dr. Julian Lewis, are you arguing in favour of a complete like-for-like replacement for Trident? Do you think that's what Britain needs on the world stage?
Yes, that's absolutely what I'm arguing for. And the reason for arguing for that is that Britain's policy remains what it's always been, which is to go for a strategic minimum nuclear deterrent. And the four-boat Trident force was judged to constitute that at the time when Trident replaced Polaris. And when the Tony Blair government did its assessment of what would need to be done to continue the strategic nuclear deterrent once the life of the existing Trident boats came to an end, the conclusion was that four new submarines should be built to replace the existing fleet.
And Mr. Fenwick, you've argued there are alternatives and that Britain's military needs the money spent elsewhere, not on a submarine equivalent of Trident.
Yeah, I think the point we made in the beginning of the year in our paper was that an eight-point plan, sitting down saying that the boats themselves are going to be unaffordable, the current defence budget would have between 22 and 28% of the total equipment programme having to be spent on the Trident boats over the 10 years, 2018 to 2028. And what we want to do is take those savings, roll them back into the conventional forces, which, as Julian is well aware, are going to require very significant investment in the same period to meet the Force 2020 requirements and retain a revisionary nuclear capability if the international situation were to change. We fundamentally don't see that Trident adds any actual level of UK security over and above that provided by our NATO allies, and therefore we don't see that it's an effective use of money.
Mr. Harris-Quinney in Berlin, do you think that's true, that what's actually happening is that money that would be spent on protecting our forces is going to be wasted on a deterrent we won't have any use for?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I think the way to see Trident is as a crucial element of our armed forces in the same way that the Air Force or the Navy is, and therefore the level of expenditure I think is appropriate. What Trident gives the United Kingdom is a strategic component that many nations within NATO do not share, and indeed the point of NATO is that we all pull our weight. The United Kingdom is one of the few nations that does. It's one of the few nations that contributes to the security of NATO. If we start stripping back on our defence capabilities, then NATO actually considerably loses as well, and we'd be relying on the French and the United States as the only nuclear powers involved.
Dr. Hudson, you've looked at the costs associated with the nuclear programme. What are the final figures you have for the cost of Trident, or the replacement for Trident, rather?
A very conservative estimate, which would take into account both the procurement of the weapons system itself and the lifetime cost, a very, very conservative estimate of that would be in excess of £100 billion. And that's no doubt one of the reasons why the majority of the population in opinion polls over a number of years has been in favour of scrapping Trident. It's also no doubt why senior military figures say that it's militarily useless and it should be scrapped and the money should indeed be spent on things which the armed forces have need for. It's a Cold War weapons system. By the government's own assessment in its recent national security strategy, it was state-on-state nuclear attack was downgraded to a level two threat. We have a new global situation where we're facing many threats and challenges. We should be getting the appropriate strategic means to deal with those threats.
Dr. Lewis, we're spending an awful lot of money to deal with a level two threat. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think Kate has got to the heart of the matter, because if you believe that it's possible to look at the international situation and say there is no serious prospect of the United Kingdom being threatened over not just the next few years, but the next 20, 30 and 40 years, the lifetime of Trident. And remember, what Kate was talking about was the costs over that very long lifetime period of Trident. If you seriously think, you can absolutely guarantee that Britain would never face a threat from a state armed with nuclear weapons, then absolutely fine, get rid of it all. But the reality is that if you look back at the conflicts in which we've been involved, not only over decades, but over the last century or more, the vast majority of them have arisen unexpectedly. And therefore, it's exactly as Ben said, you have to look at the nuclear deterrent in similar terms to looking at each of the individual armed forces, Royal Navy, Army, Royal Air Force. And it's like saying that we will divest ourselves of an ability to counter a particular form of threat, the threat of nuclear blackmail, which no amount of expenditure on conventional forces could ever counter.
So I'll just give Kate Hudson a chance to come back on that. You can't predict what's going to happen. You're giving away the guarantee of security.
Well, you can't predict what's going to happen, but you can make sure that the choices that you make minimise the possibility of bad things happening. And to replace Trident is not a neutral decision, because we have a global situation where we have the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, where countries are required not to proliferate, and in return the countries that do have them will disarm. If we have a situation in Britain where we commit to rearming for a period of, say, let's say, 30 to 50 years, then what kind of signal are we sending out to the rest of the world? We're not going down the track of disarming. We're not even effectively able to contribute to a multilateral process if we are rearming with a kind of 50-year timescale for the possession of nuclear weapons. And as Kofi Annan said when he was UN Secretary General, if some countries say they need nuclear weapons for their security, other countries will come to the same conclusion. So by the very act of replacing Trident, it won't be a neutral thing. It'll be a decision which promotes proliferation and will indeed contribute to that scenario which we least want to see 30 years down the line.
Sorry, Ms. Fenner, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, Julian, I think the immediate response is, yes, it's $35 billion in capital costs. Yes, Kate's quite right, it's $100 billion over 30 years. But the actual fact is that these threats don't emerge overnight. You talk about nuclear blackmail. You talk about the concept of strategic decoupling that was current in the 1980s. And in the 80s, actually, I would have, with a heavy heart, opted for Trident because of the fear of a conventional Soviet attack on Western Europe that would not necessarily have led the US to make a nuclear response. But the simple reality is that there is no threat to the UK homeland. The SDR makes that very clear, and makes it clear that these things will emerge only over time. So the number of divisions of tanks that are currently west of the Elbe, trying to make a quick run to Calais for some duty-free shopping, I would suggest is limited. And therefore, because these things happen over time, we actually suggest that we don't spend the money now, but that we retain the infrastructure so that if over a 10-year period, when we see this kind of threat emerging over a 10-year period, and if we were to end up in a new Cold War, and you know, let's sincerely hope that we don't, we would have the opportunity to go back to that. So ours is an integrated package that simply means that you don't have to lock yourself into what Kate already sees as a 40-year to 50-year package.
What I would say on that is that I particularly like the choice of the 10-year period, because it is absolutely to repeat the mistake that was made between 1919 and 1932, when government policy on arming and rearming was based on a belief that you could anticipate whether or not the country was likely to face a war over the next 10 years, and it was rolled forward year by year. Now, the reality is that if you take the nuclear deterrent off a situation of continuous deployment, and only then say, well, if the international situation darkens, even if we were able to see the international situation darkening to the point at which we say, right, okay, we're going to reconstitute our nuclear deterrent, can you not imagine the effect that would have on a deepening crisis when you suddenly say, well, we got rid of the nuclear deterrent because it looked apparent that there wasn't going to be a war for the next 10 years. We now see, unfortunately, it is looking more likely there's going to be a war. So guess what? In a situation of increasing international tension, we're going to reconstitute the deterrent. And I've read, Toby, with respect, your recommendations, which are that if you did have to reconstitute the deterrent, you'd be having it reconstituted by some form of bombs on aircraft, possibly aircraft from the aircraft carriers. All these things would be highly vulnerable, highly impracticable, and when you say that we can't afford to build the boats, now the reality is, if we don't build these boats, we will be saying goodbye to our submarine building capability forever, not just for the Trident successor boats, but also for the attack submarines, the nuclear-powered but conventionally armed attack submarines, which you yourself say in the report should be the cornerstone of our future fleet. So the reality of this is that it would be highly dangerous to say we're going to stand down a nuclear deterrent and only try to reconstitute it in the middle of a crisis. Highly dangerous.
You're tuned to The Voice of Russia. I'm Howell Davis, and today we're discussing Britain's nuclear deterrent. I'm joined by Dr. Kate Hudson of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Toby Finnick, Research Associate at Centre Forum, Dr. Julian Lewis, Conservative MP and former Shadow Defence Minister, and down the line from Berlin, we have Ben Harris-Quinney, Chairman of the Bow Group. Mr. Fenning.
Julian, well, firstly, thank you for having read the report, and you'll therefore also remember that the initial one is to have bombs off aircraft at 18 months, but it talks about a strategic deterrent of a reconstituted Trident over 10 years. The second point is...
Sorry, what sort of bombs would those be? Would it be free-fall nuclear bombs?
Free-fall nuclear bombs off aircraft.
And those aircraft would fly from where?
We looked at a range of scenarios. They would either be off the carriers when the carriers come online, or they would be tornadoes and potentially typhoons in the short term. The issue that we came back to was we were looking at a minimum level of deterrence, and we saw this because we didn't see that the state-on-state threat was serious for the major nuclear powers, and in any case we can rely on Article 5 of the NATO North Atlantic Charter. And the second point that you addressed...
Sorry, could you just explain...
An attack on one is an attack on all. And the only time it's been... the only time that it has been operationalized was actually after 9/11, when European forces went to the aid of the United States in sending the E3 force to the US. So the question then for Julian is, you also mentioned SSNs. Well, if you read the report in detail, you'll see on pages 52 and 53 that it recommends... further procurement of Astute precisely to cover the technical requirements at Barrow and to recover to ensure that we do have continuity through to 2030. And that's precisely the point.
You can't say that it is uneconomic to build the extra four boats which are to replace the existing four boats, but that it is economic to substitute building those four boats with building additional Astute-class submarines, which are similarly expensive. The reality of this is that it's all fantasy land, because the truth of the matter is that if you are to look back at any of the engagements, the conflicts in which we've been involved, going right back from the 1930s right up to date. Probably the only serious one which was remotely predictable was the Second World War. We had instances such as the Falklands, such as 9/11, such as the Yom Kippur War. All these things were issues that cropped up very quickly, far too quickly for any sort of timescale of warning to be given. And the interesting thing was that that 10-year rule, which is effectively what you're arguing to reinstate, Tony, and which, well, Toby, I beg your pardon, that 10-year rule was eventually scrapped in late 1932. And it was following an assessment that was done by Lord Hankey, who'd been Secretary of the War Cabinet, Military Secretary of the War Cabinet, and he had assessed the previous conflicts. And he said,
okay,
that with regard to the First World War, for example, far from having 10 years warning, they had scarcely 10 days warning of the outbreak of that terrible conflict.
Could I come in here?
Yes, sorry. Ben, come in.
I entirely agree with Julian, and I think...
Can I just put it to the pair of you that he's mentioned a bunch of wars that came up very, like Yom Kippur and the Falklands, they came up very, very, very quickly. There was no role for nuclear weapons in any of these wars, isn't that the point?
No, that isn't the point.
I mean, under what circumstances... Sorry, can I just put this to Ben, in Berlin? Under what circumstances would it be possible to use nuclear weapons? I mean, it seems almost unforeseeable and unguessable what sort of circumstances we would use nuclear weapons.
What makes nuclear war unforeseeable is the very fact that you have mutually assured destruction. It is currently the strategic position is a balance whereby other nations that hold nuclear weapons, for them it is unthinkable to use them because the retaliatory strike would decimate them as their strike would decimate the nation that they have launched on. So strategically, it is actually the holding of nuclear weapons which in many cases prevents nuclear war because it is a balance of power. Now, if there is a situation where all nations can no longer hold nuclear weapons, then that is, of course, desirable, but I don't see any potential for that. And where we are now, let's remember, we are potentially 6 months to a year away from Iran holding nuclear weapons or the enriched uranium necessary to make nuclear warheads. So we're not talking about 10 years or even 30 or 40 years into the future. We're talking about potentially 6 months away from a major and significant power in the Middle East that holds the United Kingdom and the West in enmity having nuclear weapons. And it would completely change our strategic outlook on the world and that balance of power and nuclear weapons that I've talked about. The third point that I wanted to make was that...
Briefly, please.
Holding nuclear weapons is in the world of international affairs is of strategic importance in itself. It gives the United Kingdom, rightly or wrongly, a prominence in negotiation. It makes us a very senior member of NATO and a member of NATO that other NATO countries more significantly rely on than we do them in most cases, apart from the United States.
So, Kate, what we have here is a scenario where a country that's hostile to us, the Middle East, Iran, might well have nuclear weapons very shortly, and also it gives us a seat at the big table.
Well, I think the real issue is a bit more fundamental than that. The best argument that seems to come forward is really that we need to have nuclear weapons in order that they shouldn't be used. And that seems to me absolutely bizarre. The real situation is that the vast majority of countries in the world don't have nuclear weapons. Many of them have high status and don't depend on spending billions of pounds on weapons of mass destruction in order to have that status. We have the majority of the British population systematically opposing having nuclear weapons. We have senior military figures saying they're militarily useless and they should be scrapped. The reality is that the status quo, as Toby clearly shows, the status quo on nuclear weapons and on our nuclear weapons possession has broken down. We need to look at what Britain actually needs to genuinely secure its defence, and we need to have an open mind about it. And the possibility of considering a non-nuclear replacement for Trident, you know, not having nuclear weapons at all, needs to be on the table, as well as the types of suggestions that Toby is making.
But what would be the non-nuclear equivalent that would give us the same level of security?
Well, addressing the security threats that we are facing under the national security strategy currently. They include things like environmental threats, cyber attack, organised crime, all kinds of genuine terrorism, all kinds of things which nuclear weapons bear no relationship to whatsoever. And of course, that includes things like troops, proper equipment of our troops and so on. All those types of things are genuine and understandable security needs that Britain faces and need to be addressed.
You're listening to The Voice of Russia. I'm Howell Davis, and today we're discussing Britain's nuclear deterrent. I'm joined by Kate Hudson, General Secretary of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Toby Fenwick, Research Associate at Centre Forum, Dr. Julian Lewis, Conservative MP and former Shadow Defence Minister, and from Berlin, we're joined by Ben Harris-Quinney of the Bow Group. Dr. Lewis, Sir Nick Harvey has said that one alternative perhaps to having submarine permanently on patrol would be to have what he termed having weapons in a cupboard, which then could be used later on. Do you think that would be a sort of compromise that would be acceptable?
No, it would be entirely unacceptable for the reasons I said earlier. The reason why nuclear deterrence deters is precisely as Ben said, which is the certainty that if somebody uses a nuclear weapon against a country which itself has a nuclear deterrent, it cannot escape retaliation. Now, that is the underlying thinking behind the concept of continuous at-sea deterrence. And the moment you downgrade things, either in a way that means that the retaliation would be from platforms that were vulnerable to a first strike, or that the ability to deter is not continuous, straight away you bring back a factor of uncertainty, which might mean that a potential aggressor would think it would be worthwhile. And I must say that for all that Kate says about senior military figures opposing this, there have always been a small minority of senior military figures, usually from the army, for rather obvious reasons, who are against renewal of the deterrent. But the vast majority of senior military figures are in favor of it. And similarly, with opinion polls, you can always get majorities against renewal or retention of a given nuclear weapon system. But when you ask people the question, do you think that the United Kingdom should continue to possess some nuclear weapons as long as other countries have them, you invariably get a substantial majority saying yes.
Mr. Fenwick, do you think that Sir Nick Harvey's almost compromise suggestion is one that might fly in the long term as a way of saving money and of keeping some sort of nuclear deterrent?
On Sir Nick's suggestion, actually, I agree, CASD. If you accept the Cold War thinking about nuclear deterrence, then four-boat Trident CASD is probably the answer you end up with. But I think it's time for us to move on from that, because this isn't the Cold War. We're not facing the serious threat of nuclear decoupling that did exist in the 1980s. And my question to Julian and Ben is, ultimately, in pressing for a unilateral UK nuclear program, ultimately you're saying very loudly that you don't trust the US and that you don't believe that the nuclear guarantee from Washington is serious and credible, because otherwise we wouldn't have the problem of sheltering under it in the same way that Germany does.
But it's not just about trusting the United States. It's also about doing our bit for NATO. And you talk about Germany. I think Kate was saying that there are examples of great powers that don't hold nuclear weapons. Well, the two significant examples I can think of are Japan and Germany. Now, Germany doesn't have really any significant armed forces. Germany very much relies on the structures of NATO and the European Union to provide that. If every country was like Germany, there would be no NATO.
Well, it does have troops in Afghanistan, for example, in fairly large numbers. The idea that there's no German defence arm is not true, is it?
Yes, but they operate almost entirely via international institutions, and their armed forces are not comparable in size or in capabilities to that of the United Kingdom to France, or certainly not the United States.
Well, Ben, no one's in comparison to the United States. I mean, let's be very clear about that.
No, okay,
outside
comparison to the United Kingdom and France, then.
Sure, outside.
You know, if every nation had the military structure of Germany, there would be no NATO.
And outside of the nuclear realm,
might be a more peaceful world.
and outside of the nuclear realm, I think actually Germany compares very well with France and Germany. But precisely on the point of 2% of GDP and reinvesting in the conventional forces so that we can make the kind of contribution to NATO and to our American allies, which they really value, of having high-grade conventional forces that are deployable worldwide and able to sit down and work consistently with them around the world. I think you can't explain how you're going to sit down and fund this as well as Trident. And
do you agree that NATO relies on holding a nuclear deterrent?
I do, unfortunately, whilst anyone has weapons of mass destruction of this sort, believe that NATO needs to have a nuclear core.
So therefore, A, why should the United States provide that entirely? And B, do you not acknowledge the strategic problems that having a sole provision by the United States creates?
Taking your second point first, no, I don't. And on the first point, the question of, should we be reliant on the US? Well, we aren't reliant on the US for many other things, and our contribution can be more useful in other areas. And the Americans, I think, are increasingly coming to this understanding.
Well, I disagree. I think NATO is hugely reliant on the United States, that it's in that sense unbalanced.
Dr. Lewis, just looking forward now, we've got this review that's due to come to an end by the end of this year, I suppose. What do you think will emerge from it?
Well, it's apparently something that was set up as part of a coalition compromise to keep the Liberal Democrats happy. All I can say is that if it comes forward, making suggestions, as I expect that it will, that either we should have a smaller force or a smaller and different force or a force that doesn't go down the route of continuous at-sea deterrence, then I would expect David Cameron to reject it. Because at the crucial meeting when David Cameron called all the newly elected Conservative MPs together and tried to sell us the idea, which he did, of going into coalition with the Liberals, he made it quite clear that they were going to have to accept our policy on the renewal of Trident. And so if this recommends anything other than the renewal of Trident, David Cameron would be breaking his word to the entire Conservative parliamentary party, and I don't think he would want to do that.
Kate?
I think that the outcomes of the review will be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that. But, of course, the reality is that the coalition government has put off the decision on whether or not to replace Trident until 2016, which is after the next general election. So, well, opinion polls currently being what they are, but, of course, those can change. It may well be that the current government isn't in the position to be leading the debate and the discussion around that 2016 Trident replacement decision. So, currently, of course, people who are concerned about this issue, anti-nuclear campaigners and so on, are working to really raise this debate and discuss all these issues incredibly widely. This is very, very important to Britain's future in so many ways. We have to have all those issues on the table, and of course we have to have the non-nuclear option on the table too, so that in 2016 our parliamentarians, our ministers, will be as well informed as possible about what this will mean for Britain.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Thank you all very much for taking part. I was speaking to Dr. Kate Hudson of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Toby Fenwick of Centre Forum, a think tank, Dr. Julian Lewis, Conservative MP and the former Shadow Defence Minister, and from Berlin, Ben Harris-Quinney of the Berg Group. Thank you all very much for taking part.